Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 19th of October, 2022, and this is Reconstruction with me, David Taylor, from the Construction Index magazine, and our online news editor, Phil Bishop, who joins me as per usual. Keeping abreast of political developments, Phil, or has all become a blur?
Well, I'm doing my best, Dave, but yeah, I'm starting to run out of opinions almost. I mean, what do you advise the poor Prime Minister to do? I mean, she makes a mistake and then she tries to correct it and then she's weak for correcting it and wrong, you know, she was right in the first place and shouldn't have changed it, and lordy, who knows what's going on here.
Are you feeling sorry for her, Phil? It sounds as if you're rather sympathetic.
To the person rather than the politician. I think you have to be, don't you? I mean...
Yeah, I agree, yeah.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I still wouldn't vote for the woman, but I think you'd be inhuman not to feel sympathy for the predicament that she finds herself in.
Yeah. Well, I think about now, or certainly within the next hour or so, I think she's going to be facing the leader of the opposition, isn't she? It's Prime Minister's Questions. That should be an acutely uncomfortable time for her, I should think.
Yes, we'll see what happens. But we should. On this point, David, tell listeners who may have been out of touch for the past fortnight that everything we discussed 2 weeks ago, you can forget that, folks. That's not happening.
Oh, yeah.
The growth plan we discussed a fortnight ago that the now former Chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng, announced with in conjunction with the Prime Minister, still Prime Minister, Liz Truss, that's been put in the bin, all except the planning reforms are still there. I say they're still there. It was only an aspiration. They haven't actually changed the planning laws at all, but they say they want to change the planning laws to make it easier to push through infrastructure developments and housing developments. But they've scrapped plans to reduce income tax, corporation tax, dividends tax, freeze on alcohol duty rates. That's gone. Foreign visitors, tourists can... They were going to be allowed to do VAT-free shopping. That's going. And most interestingly for the construction industry, or for a lot of people in the construction industry, the IR35 off-payroll working rules, which have been particularly contentious over the past few years, Kwarteng and Truss said last month that we're going to scrap those. Freedom for people. And new Chancellor Jeremy Hunt comes in and says, no, we're not scrapping those. They stay. And it's saving lots of money for the government, but it's costing lots of money for the taxpayers.
Not saving enough, I don't think.
I don't think they can. Well, they're going to have to save more by... I don't think they'll say they'll cut road building jobs, but I think they will... They'll find some more long grass. So it'll take longer to deliver the programme and things will just be pushed back. And they'll find reasons to... In fact, maybe they won't want to fast-track the planning reform. Maybe they want to make the planning reform more difficult, to slow things down even more, to halt public spending.
But that would also affect the private sector as well, which wouldn't be very good for growth, and I think Liz Truss is quite keen on growth, isn't she?
Yes, but the anti-growth coalition is now in charge.
Yes, that's true. I mean, do you think, obviously we've talked about some major road projects which have been, you know, sort of coming up against the buffers with legal challenges and in recent times, so that, you know, there's the Stonehenge Tunnel and then there's the Lower Thames Crossing, and I think now there's that I can't remember which road it is, the sort of Oxford to Cambridge road, that's subject to a legal challenge now, isn't it? Do you think that any of these big infrastructure jobs could end up on the scrap heap in order to save money?
I don't think they'll be totally on the scrap heap. They'll just be, it'll just be long grass time, I think, as I was saying. I think it'll push things back.
So we don't have to spend the money just yet. We can...
Yeah, yes. Some other bugger's problem. Yeah, okay. I mean, it's a, you know, the classic political fix.
Right. Well, okay. And we've got, I think Jeremy Hunt is actually going to be outlining what the spending plans are going to be fairly soon, isn't he? A week on Monday, I believe. Halloween.
Oh, it will be scary, won't it? I mean, there's going to have to be cuts. I can see no way around it. And as you say, if you're talking about cutting infrastructure spending, that is an anti-growth measure, as construction industry leaders never tire of telling us. Spending money on construction is economically virtuous. It generates more money and more wealth. One thing I'm hoping he doesn't touch in terms of spending is HS2, because they've already postponed the easy bit to postpone, the Leeds leg, which, being a son of the West Riding, was the only reason to build HS2 in the first place, was to get to Leeds more quickly and smoothly. So I slightly care less about HS2 now, as I've said. But a lot of people say, oh, I'll cut HS2, that'll save billions, that'll save the economy. Well, it won't, for various reasons. But fortunately, Jeremy Hunt has come out in the not very distant past as a strong HS2 fan. He said, It's absolutely vital. Post-Brexit, we must be ambitious for our country and hungry for our economy. What signal would it send if we cancelled our highest profile infrastructure project and weakened our commitment to share prosperity around the country? So he is, you know, I think if he goes back on that, we'll have plenty of rope to hang him with.
Well, that's true. But I mean, he wouldn't be the first one to do a U-turn, would he? Not given the recent events. I mean, when did he say that? Was that very recently, or was it a year or two ago? Because I wouldn't be surprised if he might revise his opinions, perhaps water them down a little bit.
Do you know, I made a note of this, and I don't know when it was. I think it might have been last year, but it wasn't long ago.
No, okay. All right then. Well, yeah, we'll see if he'll U-turn as well. But no, I think, as you say, I think HS2 is probably safe, because I think it's reached a stage where scrapping isn't actually possible anymore, because so much of the enabling works has been done, and, you know, we've got tunnels and all the rest of it, and we've lost a few ancient forests, or woodlands anyway. So they might as well just carry on and get up to Manchester and call it a day. I think that's probably what will happen. But I do wonder if other jobs will be, as you say, kicked into the long grass, or at least, you know, delayed for a little while.
And there's a lot, I mean, there's a big hospital building program that's going on and proceeding apace. Keep getting press releases through of new contract awards for hospital buildings. I can't see that they've got any way of slowing that down. I think that's got to be reasonably safe. I mean, we might be able to say delay one or two of them, but I think the roads program is what looks vulnerable, to be honest.
Yeah, I think that the hospital program has the advantage of being like motherhood and apple pie. Nobody is actually against it, whereas road building is a very divisive issue, and it's easier to listen to the critics and decide to revise your plans there. I think once you're committed to building hospitals, and everybody wants investment in the National Health Service, you've got to stick to that one, because it would be a huge own goal if you were to row back on that.
Well, as we know, there's been a lot of speculation about how long the Prime Minister is going to stay in post for, whether she'll be the shortest ever Prime Minister we've had, or whether she'll be able to hang on to fight the next general election, which could be as late as back end of 2024, is it, or mid-2024? It's the last time she could run. But one person who was supposed to have left their job last month and decided not to is Ray O'Rourke, majority shareholder and chief executive of Lang O'Rourke. And this is an interesting U-turn, another U-turn from Ray O'Rourke, because it was this time last year he announced that he was, I've used the word retiring, I don't think he'll ever actually retire, but stepping back to become non-executive chairman of the company. And he'd identified a guy called Seamus French as his successor, who's going to come in from Anglo American, the mining company. And this was all going to presage a stock market flotation, or some sort of flotation of the business. And it's his exit strategy. And he's announced today that actually that is not happening. Seamus French, who started as chief exec designate and MD of the European division of Lange O'Rourke, is now leaving by mutual agreement, as we always say in these things. Whether Seamus French actually said, "Can I go now, please?" I'm not sure. But Ray O'Rourke is going to stay, or is staying as chief executive for at least two financial years, which means until March 2024, end of March 2024, therefore April 2024, at least.
Yeah.
Now, he said there's not going to be any flotation. He doesn't envisage a flotation happening with him as chief executive. The plan is to get someone in who would be the, you know, the face of the company to float it. And this was seen as the role that Seamus French had been given. And I suppose it's not terribly surprising that, given the state of the economy and the markets, that it might not be the best time to float, and Seamus French was, you know, the job he was brought in to do isn't happening at the moment. But I don't know, it seems interesting. In fact, he's not only staying on as chief executive, Ray O'Rourke, of the group, he's taking over Seamus French's old job as managing director of the Europe bit as well.
I suppose, you know, somebody like Ray O'Rourke is he's quite a secretive sort of character.
Private, I think is the word.
Private, yeah. He's a very private sort of person. So you never really know what he's thinking. But he's obviously an astute businessman. He's been extremely successful. And presumably he has sufficient confidence in his own abilities to, you know, steer the ship through choppy waters. And obviously we are sort of entering choppy waters now, you know, people talking about global recession and all the rest of it. And in fact, I noticed that you ran a story, was it yesterday or today, about Lange O'Rourke's Australian outfit doing rather badly. I imagine that Ray O'Rourke thought, hang on, you know, I can't hand over to anybody else now. I've got to keep my hand on the tiller and steer us through this. So I imagine that's what's going on.
Well, I don't think the Australian thing is relevant, because that's historic. The reason why they lost money in Australia in the last financial year is because a project that they had from 2012 to 2017, I think they finished building it. There'd be an ongoing dispute about who owes what to whom at the end of it. I don't know what project that was. And there was a $75, $76 million reverse on that project, which finished 5 years ago. So the problem, as such there was, is historic. It's a legacy problem.
Oh, right, okay.
And now they've written off that money. That money's gone. And Australia's under new management anyway. And it's not a case of Ray O'Rourke saying, oh, I've got to stay because I've got to sort out Australia. Although his son, Cathal, is taking over as chairman of the Australia hub. So that's a new role for Cathal O'Rourke. Yeah. But I think it's more to do with the fact that they're not going to be able to float the business yet, and they've got to keep it going until, you know, keep the business healthy and right until he can safely get out. Because obviously it's his company. I mean, he and his brother own the company. It's roughly 65-35 or 66-34, mm-hmm. something like that. That they own the business, and obviously they don't just want to walk away and say, okay, I'm retiring. Where's my gold watch? They want to maximise the value of the company at time of exit.
Yes, of obviously. Course. Yeah. Well, I think it's safe to say that whatever his motives, Ray O'Rourke has a stronger justification for staying on than maybe Liz Truss does. I'm sure several Tory backbenchers would probably agree with that. And I know the entire Labour Party would.
Although Ray O'Rourke's reputation is assured, whatever happens.
Yes, that's true.
His reputation is made. Liz Truss may be hoping for events to emerge that will enable her, give her the opportunity to salvage her reputation. Right, next on my list is I want to talk about modern methods of construction. We talk a lot about this and
yeah.
We're all supposed to be very excited by it. It is deemed to be the future of construction, as we discussed before, that there's no point doing muddy, dirty work in the rain and on site where you can't manage people and watch people properly. Much better to build buildings indoors on production lines like Jaguar motor cars and Rolls-Royce motor cars, and you have this perfect automotive manufacturing process with Six Sigma total quality da-di-da-di-da, and this is the future of building.
Yeah. Well, it has been for a long time, remember?
We've discussed before about the vast amounts of private equity money and people like Legal & General as well spending gazillions on prefab factories, basically around a lot of them in Yorkshire, it seems to me. None of them are making any money yet. The old ones that had been around for a while make good money, but these sort of new entrants making off the shelf or flat pack housing have yet to start making money. Anyway, the reason why I want to talk about this is that I have seen the future of construction. If off-site construction is the future of construction, the future of the future of construction is offshore construction, as in offshoring it. Now, we've learnt this thanks to Bouygues. Now, we haven't decided yet whether we call them Bouygues or Bouygues.
I'm going for Bouygues.
Well, okay, I'll stick with you then, Bouygues. Bouygues have just recently completed a student accommodation project in Canterbury called the Riverside. £59 million job. And they've done it by a bit like, as we've seen it familiar with, Premier Inn and Travelodge type hotel projects, where these boxes that are all stacked on top of each other, and Bob's your uncle, you've got a building for, and it works well for, as I said before, works well for budget hotels, and it works well for student accommodation, it works well for social housing. Doesn't work quite so well yet for smart private sector housing or posh hotels that people want to spend lots of money on, because it hasn't quite got the cachet, I suppose.
But successive governments have been very, very, very enthusiastic about this. The whole off-site thing has been, as you say, the future of construction for many years. It's just that although politicians seem to like it, the market doesn't seem quite so enthusiastic.
Well, Bouygues is enthusiastic, but here's the kicker. Bouygues have not, instead of deciding to have their modular units, prefab units, built in East Yorkshire or somewhere like that and send them down road for 250 miles, which other people are doing. No one ever talks about the mileage, the ecological implications of that. But anyway,
it's deemed to
be a good thing on every front, carbon. What Bouygues have done, and it's Bouygues UK, not Bouygues in France, who initiated it, said, right, we've got this contract. We need to build a factory to build the modules. And they've built this factory in Morocco. So this factory in Morocco was used to build the modular units for this Canterbury student accommodation building and was sent by boat and probably lorry from Dover, I guess, around the world to Canterbury. And I can see that it might be cheaper to make these boxes in North Africa. I don't know what the labour standards are. I don't know how much they get paid in Morocco. But it might be slightly different terms and conditions than in the UK. And
yes, it might be.
It just all reminds me of the whole working from home thing that we've talked about. Working from home is the future. It's great. But if you can work from home, that means someone in India can do your job more cheaply and probably better. So if you work from home, you're automatically, it seems to me, at risk. Similarly, if you go down the off-site route, if you think that off-site is the future of construction, then UK construction is at risk because the construction work can all take place overseas. And I don't think that's what the government quite intended. So whether they'll have to put in new laws, which under, when you know, post Brexit, we can do this sort of thing now and say, yes, you know, we want you to build off site, but we're not going to allow you to import modules from China or Morocco or wherever. Or at least if you do that, we're going to have to put a huge import duty on these modules. So you know, maybe we'll have to, you know, protect British prefab factories.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how many people saw this coming. It came as a surprise to me. It was sort of, I received the same press release as you, and it was almost buried in there, that there, it was almost an aside that they were having these units made in Morocco. But as you say, the whole idea of, you know, our construction industry contributes an awful lot to GDP, and taking it off site is one thing, but taking it out of the country is completely different. And that is a worrying trend, I think, for a lot of people. What I wasn't aware of was that Bouygues had built this this factory in Morocco specifically for this contract, presumably. This is just the first contract that they're going to fulfill.
Yeah, any other development? The Bouygues UK CEO says this is our first self-delivered modular project. It's a really exciting milestone. Modern methods of construction is a crucial part of the future. We've learned a lot from this scheme, and it stands us in great stead for future modular projects.
Yeah.
In other words, they're saying, this is the way to go, folks. We're going down this way.
Right. And we can undercut anybody in the UK, presumably.
Yeah. So any job that we get which lends itself to modular construction, which means any budget hotel, any student accommodation, any social housing, high-rise blocks, anything like that, it's going to be built in Morocco. So if you're a client and you see Bouygues on the tender list bidding for this with a low price, by all means take that low price. We don't want to waste public money. But realise that what you're doing is you're offshoring UK construction.
Yes, very sneaky.
What slightly gets me more about all of this is that Bouygues UK have been winning prizes for this initiative. There's something called the Offsite Expo Awards 2022, which I don't think is a Moroccan award. I suspect it's a British award. Probably yeah. Some magazine promotes it or something.
Yeah.
But the Offsite Expo Awards named Bouygues Contractor of the Year for its work on this scheme.
Wow.
Well done, Bouygues. You're the best for taking work out of the UK and offshoring it to Morocco.
I mean, from the little I've seen about this, it's not a particularly sophisticated operation. I mean, it looks, you mentioned, you know, that this sort of offsite module is used for, you know, budget hotels, that kind of thing, and not for the sort of high-end residential developments. This doesn't seem any more remarkable to me than any number of projects which I've seen in the past, except for the fact that the modules are being made outside the UK. I mean, am I missing
yes.
something?
No, as far as I can tell, that is the... I mean,
yeah.
50, I don't know what this building... 430 modules, 491 bedrooms, £59 million. I'm sure some listeners will know immediately that they've got 491 bedrooms for £59 million. Pounds. That's a bargain.
That's a bargain. Yeah.
But I don't know whether that's the case or not. I mean, no. For all I know, that could be expensive. But maybe they did it hugely quickly. No, like you, it seems to be, you know, a fairly textbook state of the art. Yes, yeah. But textbook modular put together building.
But I mean, Bouygues is Bouygues UK at least. I don't know what they're doing in France, but they seem new to this offsite business. And you know, their sort of unique selling point is the fact that they can get, you know, the cheap Moroccan made modules at a good price. Is it just the UK arm of Bouygues? I mean, is this factory owned by Bouygues UK, or is it supplying the whole of the company, the bigger company, sort of Europe wide?
They have Bouygues, not Bouygues UK, but the Bouygues Group, Bouygues mm-hmm. Construction Group in France. They built the factory using Bymaro, Bouygues Morocco, BYMARO. It's their Morocco subsidiary. And
right,
not only was it their own labour in Morocco and their own company in Morocco, it was their own logistics company that did all the shipping and logistics.
Oh, right, okay.
So this was an end-to-end Bouygues operation. And I thought that's impressive, and it's great if you're French.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got any interest in the health of the British economy and British construction, you might rather wish that the French had put more of their money into the UK supply chain than, shifted it to Morocco.
That reminds me of a story which we touched on in a recent episode about an energy company, a renewable energy company that was going to import low carbon renewable energy from Morocco. Do you remember that? I don't.
Yes, was that Morocco as well? I remember it was being Morocco. North Africa. I can't remember the detail of it.
It was on the east coast of Morocco, which is both windy and sunny. And so right. It was a UK-based outfit. They were going to build this energy farm out in Morocco, and then put in this massive pipe. Well, not a pipeline, but a
cable,
an undersea cable going all the way up past the Bay of Biscay, and coming ashore near where I live in Devon, actually. And so we're going to get all that lovely renewable energy from Morocco. But I can see the argument for that, because, you know, Morocco is eastern Morocco is largely desert. It's very sunny and it's very windy. And if you can harness all that natural energy and then import it to a developed economy that really needs the energy and needs the reduction in carbon footprint, I can see the justification for that. I don't think it's quite as easy to justify Bouygues' decision to offshore the actual construction of a UK development, because that doesn't seem to... Well, it's a completely different sort of proposition, isn't it?
Well, no, I actually don't have a problem with Bouygues doing this. It's clearly in their interest. I mean, they exist to make money for shareholders, which is the Bouygues family. And it's fair enough that they should do things as efficiently. In fact, it's right that they should do things as efficiently and profitably and with the right quality, et cetera, as they can. So I don't really have a problem with Bouygues. I have a problem with the client who let them get away with it.
Yeah.
Frankly. I mean, that's, you know, it's follow the money.
And the awards people who gave them an award.
To give them a prize, yes. So, but
yeah.
I just say that, you know, if you want to rave about off-site construction, remember that it can just as easily be offshore construction.
Yeah, very good point. Very good point.
And they're not the only French in the news at the moment, are they?
They're not. There's even worse out there.
Oh, much worse. Tell me the story you posted this morning.
Oh, well, it was I got a press release from the United States Justice Department. Turns out that Lafarge, everybody knows who Lafarge is, you know, French cement company, now owned by Holcim, a Swiss organisation.
But they were French at the time, and that's what
they were French at the time, yeah. And, and you know, yeah, huge materials group. Anyway, they've been doing something which you really wouldn't expect a global building materials producer to do, and that's funding terrorism. They've been fined a huge amount of money. I think it's about nearly 800 million US dollars in the in an American court for paying bribes,
which is about 800 million pounds these days, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, they were paying bribes to no less than ISIS or IS or the Islamic State or whatever you want to call it, and the al-Nusra Front, the Syrian terrorist group, allied terrorist group, because Lafarge had built a cement factory through a subsidiary, Lafarge Cement Syria. They built this factory in Damascus. And, of course, when it all kicked off with the Syrian civil war in... When was that? 2011? Something like that. And of course, ISIS suddenly came out of the shadows and were occupying a lot of that part of the world. Rather than sort of shut up shop and get out of there as quickly as possible, they started paying bribes to ISIS and the al-Nusra Front in exchange for permission to operate the plant. The bribes allowed LCS to obtain approximately 70.3 million US dollars in revenue as a result of this, only over the course of a couple of years, actually. It was just 2013 to 2014. Anyway, they did all this and they paid the bribes, and Lafarge executives knew all about it and just kept stum. And so then, you know, obviously the truth will out eventually, and there was an investigation, with which Lafarge and also Holcim, the new owner, didn't really cooperate, according to the American courts. They sold the business to Holcim in 2015, didn't say anything about this. Holcim didn't ask any questions. And they tried to just sweep it underneath the carpet. And as I say, it came out. And some of the American, the Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General, Matthew Olson of the Justice Department's National Security Division was absolutely withering. He said the defendants routed nearly $6 million in illicit payments to two of the world's most notorious terrorist organizations, ISIS and al-Nusra Front in Syria. At a time, those groups were brutalizing innocent civilians in Syria and actively plotting to harm Americans. It's astonishing. It's astonishing that that sort of thing would happen. I'd like to think that most multinational materials manufacturers or any big multinational group would draw the line at something quite so heinous as funding terrorism, paying bribes to, you know, the most depraved terrorist organizations that we've ever seen. But here they are quite happy to do it. It seems astonishing.
One thought that occurs to me about all of this, without at all sticking up for, I mean, Lafarge deserve everything, you know, the fine and more that's coming their way, appalling behaviour. But I'm not quite sure what it's got to do with the US Justice Department. This is a French company in breach of international and natural law, it seems to me, in the Middle East. How does this come under US jurisdiction? I mean, is the Maltese justice system and the Peruvian justice system going to start prosecuting Lafarge? They're going to be up in every court in every country of the world and facing fines.
That's a very good question.
Does the US have some special powers to police the world? That,
you know what, I failed to ask that question. It is a very good point. I don't honestly know why in is America. I mean, in a way, it was a bit personal for the Americans. I mean, they having, and for the UK, of course, having been deeply involved in Iraq and that general area, fighting terrorism and fighting Saddam and all the rest of it.
The Americans weren't alone.
No, they weren't alone. But I mean, there is a school of thought, which is that ISIS was actually nurtured by the activities of Western powers in that part of the world, that it was a response to US, UK and other Western countries. It sort of created the vacuum that ISIS was created to fill. So I don't know, in a way it was personal for the Americans because they had a beef with ISIS. But yeah, so did we, so did the French, so did the Australians and so many others. Why this was an American court case, I don't honestly know. I will look into it because I'm curious to find out now. They're clearly not the last court of appeal in the world, so that wouldn't have been it. I don't know is the answer to that.
So my advice to any listeners who share our strong feelings about how appalling it is that Lafarge fund terrorism or have funded terrorism is that next time you see a bag of Lafarge cement, chuck a tin of soup over it.
Yes, well, of course, that's very effective. Astonishing, quite astonishing. I mean, so Lafarge, I have to say, right at the end of the story, I did find a quote from Lafarge saying that it deeply regretted the events and that it accepted responsibility for the individual executives involved and said that their behaviour had been a flagrant violation of its code of conduct. But those are...
Is this Liz Truss getting rid of Kwasi Kwarteng?
Well, it's saying, that sort of thing. Yeah, it wasn't me, Governor.
We're sorry that he did that.
Yes, precisely. Yeah, throwing somebody under the bus. I mean, what else could they say, really? I mean, it's a fair cop, Gov, is the only other response I can think of. It's a bit worrying, makes you think, you know, maybe there are other highly respected organisations out there with dirty laundry that's just as filthy as this. You never know.
Okay, I'm just Googling French corporate bribery scandals, and a few come up. And this might answer our question as why the US court that prosecuted it. Total, the oil company, was fined £245 million a few years ago for Iran bribing illegal payments to a government official in Iran. And the reason why it's the US Department of Justice is because Total, their shares trade on the New York Stock Exchange. So I would imagine that Lafarge and Holcim trade on the New York Stock Exchange. So that might be it. Other ones, there's a whole bunch of them. It's just Google French corporate bribery cases, and
And while you're at it, try Italian ones, German ones, Dutch ones, and in fact British ones. I'm sure that you'll find something there.
You're so fair.
Well, I quite
having said that, I love France. I love the French, and I'm going there next month, and I'll have a lovely time.
Well, let's hope so. I mean, if this leaks out, you never know. So, well, we've trashed the French. We've trashed Liz Truss. Anything else we want to have a pop at?
Well, there was one topic I had on the list, which I thought worthy of discussion. I don't think we're going to be able to completely dissect it, given the few minutes remaining to us. But we've talked before about the building licensing scheme that Federation of Master Builders have been promoting. In Scotland, they're focusing their attention much more on electricians, which I think has, in terms of protecting the trade of electricians, and I think that has a slightly stronger case. I'm still instinctively against it, I think, but I get it. Anyway, draft legislation, it's been laid by a Tory MSP, so I can't imagine it's going to get through. It's like a equivalent of a Scottish private members bill. It's been laid before the Scottish Parliament that if passed, it would protect the job title of electrician. It would give the electrician the sort of professional status that architects have. You can't call yourself an architect unless you're properly whatever. But engineers and surveyors, anyone, you and I can call ourselves an engineer or a surveyor. At the moment, we can call ourselves, you can't call yourself a chartered engineer or chartered surveyor.
Okay.
But, you know, they're not protected terms in any sense.
Right,
only the term chartered is. Now, electrician would become, in Scotland, rather like gas safe or Corgi registered plumbers, as we used to talk about them. Gas safe registered.
Yes.
It's a crime for anyone to work on domestic or, I guess, industrial gas systems in a house, you know, fix your boiler, if they're not on the gas safe register.
No.
Similarly, this legislation, if it passes, would mean, I think you'd still be allowed to change a plug without being on the register of, you know, registered Scottish electricians. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen somewhere that they're able to define what grade of electrical work would be out there. Because they make the point that every year, thousands of people either cause fires or get electric shocks through electrical malfunctions. It's a safety issue, and it's important that people carrying out electrical work are qualified and able to do so. Which
you can't really argue with that.
Some sense. But hairdressing, lots. I've seen clips of people getting burnt by hair dryers catching fire and cutting themselves with hair, you know, hair scissors. And yes, I wouldn't want my hair cut by someone who'd never done it before. I made that mistake at school once. But do you therefore want, you know, every hairdresser to have a license? And it's this whole thing of, you know, you can only do a job if the government have given you a ID card saying there you're officially allowed to do that job.
Well, it's the safety aspect, isn't it? I mean, having a bad haircut is depressing, but it's not going to prematurely end your life. Whereas, you know, a really badly wired installation, I don't know what, a piece of machinery or something like that, if it causes a fire or it puts thousands of amps through you, it's going to kill you. I can see the safety aspect of it. I mean, I'm very careful with anything electrical because you can't smell electricity, you can't see it. You only know when you've come into contact with it when you get shocked. And so I think obviously dealing with electricity requires a level of competence that probably is in excess of what you would expect from a hairdresser. So I can see there's an analogy with, you know, with gas. Gas is the same sort of thing. It's one of these. It's an element that you can't really control very easily unless you know exactly what you're doing, and is very dangerous if it gets out of control. So I can see the thinking behind it. Where I see possible problem is what you've just pointed out. At what level do you impose this restriction? Because clearly you can't say, oh, you can't rewire that plug because you're not qualified, or you can't, you know, replace that light bulb or whatever it happens to be. I mean, it has to be something which requires a level of expertise far in excess of what you'd expect the average house owner to have, for example. There's nothing you can do with a gas installation without being gas safe registered. I mean, I can't think of a domestic operation that, apart from cleaning the top of my hob, I can't think of anything else I can do to a gas installation that wouldn't require me to be gas safe registered. So there is a bit of a grey area there, I think.
I just feel instinctively, I would rather it was consumer-led. I would rather consumers were educated, or clients educated, to check the... and actually, at a business level, I don't think it's an issue. It is a domestic issue that they want, that this pertains, I think. But I'd rather consumers were educated to... If they're having someone in to do anything which could damage, whether it's, you know, hang wallpaper or change the fuse box or put a boiler in, to say, could you just show me your City and Guilds or your MVQ or something? Show me something that you that assures me that you are competent.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't, because the guy down the pub said, oh, they're cheap, get them in.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't. We should. It should be second nature. It should be the first thing we do when engaging anyone to do anything, is say, show us your City and Guilds, MVQ, your document.
Yeah. Well, we don't. I mean, domestic consumers just don't do that.
It seems rude. It seems cheeky.
Yes, it does. Yeah, I think maybe this is a British thing that, you know, we don't like to question somebody's credentials when they come to the door, or, you know, if you phone them up and say, you know, I need a chimney repointing, you know, you call the bloke up because he did your neighbour's chimney and he did a good job. You don't ask to see his qualifications. And to do so, yes, he would probably be affronted, I should think. But maybe we should, because if he went for a job on a commercial site, he would be asked to produce his credentials and prove that he was competent. There's no reason why he should not be insulted by that from a commercial client, and he should be from a domestic client. But that's not the way we operate. That's not the British way, is it?
Right, anything else on your list, David? Anything else you want to talk about?
No, I think we've covered all bases. Probably talked for far too long yet again, but an interesting discussion. I'm sure that the great British government will continue to provide us with material to discuss in the podcast in the weeks and months to come.
Okay, well, I'll round it off and just say... Thank you once again to everyone for listening. But for another episode of Reconstruction, I've been Phil Bishop and he's been David Taylor. Thank you very much and goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.